Welcome to the Portion Podcast. I'm Aaron Roller, and I'm here with my co-host, Rabbi Jonathan Bienenfeld. This is a weekly podcast about the Parshat HaShavua, the weekly Torah portion. This week is Parshat Lech Lecha, the third Parsha of the Book of Genesis, Sefer Bereishit. Rabbi Bienenfeld, how are you?
I'm doing great. Good to be back with you, Aaron.
Yeah, this is our second recorded episode. What was your feedback on the first one?
Great feedback. And yeah, I think it's appropriate to just take a minute to really thank everybody, all the love that we got from a podcast that didn't really get even posted to all of the major platforms and just sort of went around through social media, friends and family. So thanks to everybody who took a listen. Thank you for all of your feedback, and feedback was really wonderful. Thanks very much.
Yeah, hopefully by the time you're hearing this, we'll be on iTunes and Stitcher. Maybe Google Play. So if you're hearing it on any of those platforms, please subscribe. We definitely want to make sure that you're catching this every single week. Anything new in your life? Anything new going on?
Parshat Lech Lecha is what's going on in my life.
You're thoroughly immersed in Torah. That is excellent. I was at the Philadelphia Museum of Art this week. I saw an exhibit by an Israeli video artist. She makes these three videos where there's like a Polish politician calling for the Jews to come back to Poland. It is extremely disturbing. It's sort of like a reverse diaspora.
It's like a reverse Lech Lecha.
There's the segue. Yeah, he's like, we need 3 million Jews back in Poland.
That's extremely disturbing. Wow, if we're going to be doing this on a weekly basis, I'm going to have to start doing some of these interesting things that you do so that I can share them with our
audience. I'll just feed them to you and get your response.
But I've done nothing that interesting this past week. It's interesting hearing about your interesting things.
It was pretty weird, and it was also like curious that this is the Israeli art that makes it into the Philadelphia Museum of Art.
That's really disturbing, twisted, and sad all at the same time.
So with that in mind, let's jump into Parshat Lech Lecha. So I wanted to start with just the first words I think are evocative for so many people. Lech Lecha. They sort of have a poetic sound to them.
Sure.
But then they also mean walk to yourself, walk for yourself, different translations.
You are absolutely translating it right, and you're alluding to the first comment that Rashi makes on this week's parsha, which is exactly that. Quoting from the Medrash, Rashi talks about how Lech Lecha is just that. It's for yourself, meaning this is going to be a tremendous move for Abraham. This is where he is going to come into his own. This is going to be for his own good and for his own benefit. Rashi says, Lehanatcha, Letovatcha, it's going to be for your benefit and for your good. It's here that he's going to become a great nation. It's here that he's going to be blessed, and that he's going to be wealthy, and that he's going to be, that he's going to achieve prestige. And all of the things that one could hope for, which we should remember seems somewhat backward, right? At the time, Abraham is really leaving what is the epicenter of civilization at the time in leaving to Canaan. So this is a sort of a startling promise, but one that obviously we see actually unfolds and comes to fruition later on in the parsha.
So I like that Rashi says that he has to be promised this because usually when you travel a lot, it doesn't help your reputation, it doesn't help your family life, and it doesn't help your success, you know, career-wise. And it's interesting that as the more times I've gotten older and moved, and as you're, you know, like, and the last time we moved, we hired movers, and you're just like, oh my God, I can't believe I have to do this again.
Say it's one of the most stressful things that a person can do, right? I think marriage, moving, death in the family, I don't know.
Maybe divorce more than marriage.
Hopefully.
Anyway, what strikes me is that it's this call to become yourself. It seems like very universal in the sense that you have to set out on this journey. And it seems like you don't know where you're going to go. It's going to be full of uncertainties. You have to leave the comfort and security that you once knew. And yet that's the only way, by facing that uncertainty, that you're actually going to achieve anything. And that, it seems like there's something very universal about that. I think of Joseph Campbell and The Hero with a Thousand Faces, where he kind of says that all stories, you know, or this is kind of like a classic motif of stories, you know, like the Star Wars or, you know, the Wizard of Oz or something like here. There's a call to action. You're going to go out on a journey. But what's interesting, and I think the Torah is interesting, like in that it always, it'll have these elements. But then, of course, because it's the Torah, it's this transcendent divine document, it's going to vary in very, very specific ways. In this respect, like there's no Obi-Wan Kenobi. There's no Glinda the Good Witch. It's God. like Abraham has God telling him to,
which really is better, I think, if you think about it.
Obi-Wan and...
I feel very comfortable with Obi-Wan by my side, but I really like having God there.
It's really powerful, but I think that the message, though, and I think, you know, when I was back in high school, I had a chavrusa with somebody, I was a study partner, with somebody who was becoming Jewish, and he said that this was the parsha that really spoke the most deeply to him.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Because similar to Avraham, he had to get out from his family's house and go on this journey in order to become who he was going to be. So I think that that's really, just the words themselves are extremely evocative and influential. And I was wondering, I want your thoughts, do you think that Avraham is the most influential person to ever live?
Without a doubt. I don't think there's any question. I don't think anybody could bear that title more easily than Avraham. We as Jews look at things through the lens of Jewish history and the chosenness and chosen nation, being given the Torah and et cetera, et cetera. But even more broadly than that, in a universal sort of way, I mean, Abraham gave the gift of ethical monotheism. And I don't think that living in the Western world as we do today, we appreciate enough just what a remarkable and extraordinary gift that really is. What it means to have a divine figure who is perfect, who can serve as a role model for our kindness, for our goodness, for the way that we act, the way that we act towards one another, religiosity, building community, helping one another, as we see throughout Avraham's career, his reaching out to others, his attempt to help others, his attempt to save others, his attempt to just give other people a good meal, all of which we just take for granted as basic values that we presume are ubiquitous to all of the human race and all of human history. But nothing could be further from the truth. And we know of barbarism and all kinds of just horribly wayward, backward societies that Avraham really almost unilaterally got the ball going and putting an end to. Even polytheistic religions today, they are not the polytheistic religions. We're not talking about, gladiators facing off for sport or human sacrifices or, the Aztecs like ripping each other's hearts out just for the sake of, of human sacrifice and trying to curry divine favor. Those things just don't exist anymore. And it's because of Avraham.
I want to move on to the fact that like the whole story seems to shift at this point. Right, we are going from the story of humanity to humanity's destruction to now it's really the story of this one family and the story of the Jewish people, and also the story of going to this land. It really gets to the heart of something which is, I think, both very fundamental to Judaism, but also something which puts us a little bit on the defensive, which is the notion on both levels, the notion of the exclusivity or chosenness, which is something which has been both a source of pride for Jews and I think a source of anti-Semitism in some regards, or just a little bit of, you Jews are very condescending, where, you think you're the chosen people. And then also, as we see, unfortunately, every day in the news, like, you think you're in this chosen land. And we get them both really at the outset of this, one verse in the Torah gives both. Like, I'm choosing you, and you're going to go to this place. Why does that happen?
There's this ditty, and there's one version, and then there's the response. How odd of God to choose the Jews? And then the response is, it's not that odd. The Jews chose God. And that's, fortunately, it's what we're missing. It's what we don't see. We don't actually see that in the Torah. We don't actually see the verses of the Torah clearly indicate that process and how it was that Abraham came to choose God. But we believe, we have a tradition, and frankly, it just makes the most sense that God didn't, you know, point a divine finger at some random guy living in the middle of the Fertile Crescent and say, "Ah, I think it's going to be you," any more than he chose Noah at random.
Well, even more so, like, we are going to learn, not necessarily super directly, but there are clearly other, like, we get Melchizedek later in this parsha. Like, there are other people who kind of have a sense of there being one God. It isn't necessarily the case, as we might say in a simplistic way, that Abraham is the inventor of monotheism.
Correct, right. So, he's the rediscoverer of monotheism, or he's really he's the publicizer of monotheism.
But it's also that there's something special about him, because there are other people around who maybe, you know, who maybe also share this. It's like, I mean, I don't know if it's like quite like Columbus, but like, you know, we say, oh, Columbus discovered America. And then we say, oh, no, there actually were
people,
all kinds of people. You know, it's like, but then he ends up with all the credit. And, you know, it's like, so there's something, I don't know if there's something special about Columbus. That I don't know if the metaphor extends that far, but there's something else that's special about Abraham. And also what's really interesting is that you could imagine him going through this philosophical process and saying, there's one God in the world, I've figured it out, it's rational that it should be that way, and then nothing. He just goes through his life as this guy who has this strongly held conviction. What we're getting is, you know, he comes upon this conviction, and then God shows up. Not all people who believe in one God get God, you know, then giving them direct instructions. So there's
That's exactly right. Meaning it cannot be. It just cannot be that God either chooses Abraham at random. And as you mentioned, there are other people who are still holding the torch of monotheism, and they don't get picked. This must have been a process of selection, as opposed to either, again, a completely
process of elimination.
Either process of elimination or a complete, you know, random sort of lottery, and Abraham's name happens to be drawn up out of the hat. It's not accidental. It cannot be accidental. What's odd is that what we would ordinarily expect if we were, you know, choreographing the entire story is that we would probably share some of the backstory and what Abraham's childhood was like, and this is why he was ultimately chosen. We really get it after the fact, which is maybe important also. How many people would be given the opportunity for a covenant? How many people would be given the opportunity for a relationship with God? And the stage is set, and it's just yours for the taking, and totally botch it. But from here on out, what we read about Abraham is just remarkable. I mean, the kinds of things that he does, the kind of person that he is, the interactions that he has, his sense of fairness and consideration and hospitality are the sorts of things that, frankly, we just didn't see from Noah previously. It could be argued that the stage was set for Noah to be able to walk right into a covenant also, but he just doesn't make anything of it afterwards.
So let's get into some of those actions. But first, the question of the land of Israel, the land of Canaan, same land. You know, why is there, you know, why does God have to choose anybody, and why does God choose a land?
Yeah, I think those are two very different questions, or at least perhaps they're two different questions. I'm not sure. Maybe they're really very intertwined. You know, I think, and Aaron, you mentioned before, right, that it's almost, there's something condescending about saying chosen nation. There's something that doesn't quite sit well with us. I just think that we need to be able to create a distinction between those two things. There's the reality of chosenness, and then there's the question of what exactly that means in terms of our attitude, our demeanor, our bravado. What it means to be chosen in this context is that God's goodness needs to have some sort of conduit, right, into society, into the human race. That's who we are. That's who we believe we are. That's what Abraham viewed himself as. This is why he's going around and spreading the good word and hospitality and being a good person and trying to reflect God's goodness to the greatest degree possible. It's an issue. It's an issue when we take that and we turn it around and become condescending. Every classroom needs a teacher. You know, every impressionable whomever needs a role model. And we should view ourselves more as role models, people who step up to the challenge of showing what it means to live a good, honest, religious, God-fearing sort of lifestyle, not people who just take that package and use it for nothing more than prestige and to laud ourselves over the, over other people.
Definitely daunting. Both the I struggle less with hopefully less with being condescending and more with trying to actually live the example here. I mean, I like to think of chosenness in the metaphor I read about from Rabbi Jonathan Sacks about like being a prince or being the rich man's child, where you have an estate, a business that, you know, a source of income, you know, whatever, all kinds of things that are coming your way, but it doesn't, you know, you didn't earn that when you're born. You've got to, you know, you've got to live up to it, and maybe you may inherit it even if you never deserve it, but it's inherent, it's incumbent upon you to try to get there. But regardless, I think that starting at the beginning here, where Avraham is the one who does earn it. He's if we're the children of a, you know, a wealthy man or a king, he's the king, I think, or he's the wealthy. He's the one who earned the wealth. But I think also that it's like a matter of there being, you know, if God wants a drama to be playing out in the world, there's like a stage set and there's a, you know, a protagonist. And it's certainly, you know, again, Avraham becomes the protagonist, and the land of Israel, for whatever reason, becomes the stage setting that God picks. And so they get to the land, though, and he's not there very long. He's beset by famine pretty quickly, and then he's off to Egypt. So is there a connection there between him going to Egypt and his children being slaves in Egypt?
Yes, definitely. So this really, there's a whole rabbit hole here that we could, you know, tumble down. But suffice it to say that this is really a view that was expressed most famously, I guess, by the Ramban, by Nachmanides, which is, as we say, Masa Avot Siman Labanim, that what it is that takes place in the lives of the Avot, of the patriarchs, the matriarchs, the earlier generations, becomes something of a Siman. It becomes an indication. It becomes a almost a paradigm for what's going to occur to the Banin, to the latter generations. And you find this as an ongoing theme, and the Ramban Nachmanides is all over this, all throughout Bereshit, and then even leading into Sefer Shemot. There are like overlapping themes that occur again and again and again throughout history, but that we're hopefully continuously climbing upward and climbing upward and climbing upward. There is something about needing something to occur, take place in microcosm in an earlier generation to give us the strength, the ability, the fortitude to be able to see that destiny then play out later on in history.
Well, it's like fractal geometry, right? Where the thing that happens on the small scale then kind of you see the same structure repeating again and again on different scales.
I was not going to give that example, but exactly right.
Well, just when I was a kid, I had a Trapper Keeper that had a picture of a fractal on the cover. So that's how I learned about fractals.
That's amazing. I think I had a kid on a skateboard on my Trapper Keeper.
I had that on a folder.
Unfortunately, I never learned how to skateboard, so I guess your Trapper Keeper had a better impact on you than it had on me.
Anyway, gets down to Egypt, and he says to his wife, he says to Sarai, who later becomes Sarah, I see you are a beautiful woman, and they're going to kill me and take you if they find out that I'm your husband. So we're going to tell them that I'm not your husband, that I'm your brother. So sure enough, he's right. She does get taken, it seems like immediately, to the Pharaoh's harem. And the thing that a couple of things struck me in this, but something I never thought before reading the Parsha this week was like, what was the best case scenario after that happened? We happen to get divine intervention. God afflicts Pharaoh and he realizes that Avraham is her husband, and he says, you know, you lied to me. And Avraham says, well, you know, I was, look what happened. I was afraid you were going to kill me. And, you know, he then gets escorted out of the country. But like, had God not intervened in that way, it just seems like where's the story go at that point?
Yeah, right. So, right, what ends up happening really is the best case scenario, I suppose. The question is that something that Avraham could possibly have presumed was going to happen? I don't know. Maybe yes, maybe no. But it is uncomfortable. I mean, it's uncomfortable because of, I think, the lens through which we view even the lives of the patriarchs is that of the Torah itself, and the ethical imperative that comes along with it. And one of the major no-nos in Judaism, and one of the cardinal sins of Judaism, is the idea of effectively violating matrimony and violating married woman in this case. And that it's sort of like almost an alley-oop that Avram gives to Pharaoh, almost like setting up that scenario for him to violate without knowing on the one hand, and on the other hand, he's going to be killed. One thing that's very, very interesting to think about, and I don't know that this makes it any less disturbing or maybe creates a scenario or an explanation of, well, maybe the ends justify the means. But it's such an interesting thing to think about that Avraham may have already sensed or suspected or felt with the promises that had already been given to him by God that he was really a nation of one. Right? We never really think along those lines. We think about a nation as being comprised of thousands and tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands and millions of people. And Avram's carrying it all alone. He's the nation. He's the chosen nation. He feels this burning responsibility to ensure that somehow or another he's able to then pass that baton to the next generation. I wonder if on some level that creates an environment of the ends justifying the means a little bit more than we would ordinarily suspect or demand or allow for an average Joe or just a member of that nation in later generations.
I mean, there is a theory that I don't remember where I read it, but or just an idea, an observation that we see, which is that like there's a lot like there's a degree of like exceptions that prove the rule in the Torah, like in the stories of the Avot, like the like Yaakov marrying two sisters, or Yaakov favoring the younger firstborn over the older firstborn child from the different mothers. So there's a degree to which like the things which we almost in an instructive way, and you have to then sort of dig down to figure out why this is the case or why there's an exception here. But like there are certain things we see that are almost like diametrically the opposite of what we know is usually the case. And again, there's it's a complicated matter, but it's in there.
And stay tuned because it's going to happen again. It doesn't just happen once.
It must have been a super awkward conversation, like every piece of it. And like that walk out of Egypt is like, well, we made it out alive, but this was a really weird thing that happened from start to finish. But the other thing that really, I had never thought of it, but I think it's because, this year and all the debates around immigration and what we're seeing, news reports about family separations at the border is that I think that, you talk about the Masa Avot Simon Labanim, that what happens with the patriarchs reflects later on for the children is we talk about the Jewish people as being open to strangers, and you welcome the stranger as being the product of having gone down to Egypt. But going the experience that Avraham and Sarah, what they go through, they are essentially refugees. They are leaving a famine, and you're crossing this border. And you're crossing a border into a place which is not welcoming at all, where you're taking your life in your hands. You don't know what's going to happen to, husband and wife are going to be separated. And it's really interesting that it's a sensitive. I think in the past, I never thought about it in such human terms. But I think that just the times we're living in bring it home in a way that is like, really, this was like this was a horrible thing that happened to them. And I never thought about the challenge of it in that way.
Yeah. And we're told, it's not even Avram and Sarah alone, but when this gets repeated again in history, and when the Jewish people are all enslaved in their entirety in Egypt, that's pointed to as a watershed moment in Jewish history. But thereafter, when we are establishing or reestablishing our society and our kingdom in Israel, we're reminded of that sensitivity, and we're told ki ger ha'isa b'Mitzrayim, that it's that you need to maintain greater sensitivity to those who don't necessarily have have as much as you, who don't necessarily have the same sort of support system, who are on
don't have a place to go,
rocky terrain, don't have a good place to go, don't have the people around them that you would ordinarily expect that would take care of them. Gary Atom Valmana, we speak about somebody who's a convert to Judaism, somebody who's orphaned or a widow, and we need to maintain an extra sensitivity. I think we should think about that in terms of that. We need to think about that, you know, if not strictly speaking within the parameters of those three individuals. But we, as Jews, we need to think more broadly about all the things that you're saying, what it means to see people who don't necessarily have the support system that the rest of us necessarily take for granted.
Then we have a moment. There's a moment here in the Parsha then where, and first of all, we get the image of the sand and the stars, where God, you know, says, I'm going to multiply your descendants. You're going to be the father of many nations. But he has, you know, but then Avraham says, Bama Eda, how can I know? Like, is there a sign you can give me? Which I think in rabbinic tradition is, and really not a great leap, is interpreted as a little bit of a lack of faith. You know, just a small drop after all he's done. But the so he has this Brit Ben Avatarim. God says, okay, you know, here's what you're going to do. You're going to go out and take these animals and cut them in half and put like one half of an animal on one side and one half on the other side. You're going to walk between. It's like, so when this happens, there's a moment. It's like in a horror movie when there's like the premonition and like, you know, there'll be like a shot of like somebody's eye and the corona is expanding. Is that right? The iris? I don't know what part of the eye expands, but which part is the iris? I think
corona is a beer. I think
that's an eye. Isn't it part of the eye?
I think a cornea.
Cornea.
I think a corona is a beer.
We might need to delete this out.
No, this is the best part of the podcast.
Oh dear. The point is like, you know, is that the eyes expanding and like the sun turns a different color and the crows are chirping,
the
and
vultures,
it's like,
and the vultures,
yeah, you know what I'm talking about. Like, I don't even know what movie that actually comes from.
It's very odd, but there is overt reference to the idea that the vultures descend upon these parts of the animal flesh that's been like torn apart, severed,
yeah,
on either side of the aisle. The vultures come down and a point is made by the Torah that Avram has to come and sort of shoo the vultures away.
Yeah, it says, and the eagle came down upon the carcasses and Avram drove them away, and when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon him. Like, it's just, oh, and lo, a horror of great darkness fell upon him. That's the Koran translation.
It's really
so it's just like, yeah, it's a pretty intense moment. And one thing I take from it is that like the, not from the horror movie montage, but just from the idea, like, that if, you know, because God says that's when he has the prophecy that his children are going to be slaves in Egypt. So you'd say, would they not have had to go to Egypt had he not said that? Is this lack of faith? And then if you're going to say that, it's sort of a logical progression here. If the reason for the slavery in Egypt is so that we, the Jewish people, can assume the role of people who had been victims, who had suffered, can identify with those who are suffering, can stand up to oppression. Could it be that had he not asked that question, that Avraham would have been able to impart that feeling? And we struggle to have that feeling, let's be honest. But like, if that's what we're supposed to have, that's what Egypt was supposed to impart to us, that maybe had Avraham not said those two words of Bama Eda, how would I know, that we as a nation would not have had to experience it. We would have maybe been able to have the sensitivity. Maybe we would have had the sensitivity from Avram's experience of having gone to Egypt and you know what he went through, but we would have been able to carry it with us without that. I don't know. That's sort of my working theory on that.
I think you're right in the sense that yes, that's the corollary to that rabbinic tradition, that by posing the question, Bame'eda, with what shall I know? What do you mean with what shall you know? What happened to your faith? And look, it's always very, very difficult to try to, you know, put ourselves exactly in the shoes of just the most extraordinary, you know, personalities who have ever lived. But it is remarkable that even somebody like Avraham, on whatever his level was and whatever his closeness and his connection, his relationship with God was, yes, faltered on some level with his faith and with the absolute knowledge that God's going to make it all happen. And he poses this question, but me'edah, like, how will I actually know? Give me some kind of proof. So yeah, if you connect the dots, And we look at the entire unfolding of the Brit Bein HaBetarim afterwards, and the promise that you're going to descend down to Egypt and you're going to be a stranger in a strange land for 400 years, that none of that would have happened had he not posed that question, then this is some sort of process of purging that lack of faith from Avraham and from his consciousness. So let's look at it in reverse. Let's connect those dots. You're correct. If that hadn't happened, then we wouldn't have descended to Egypt. And then apparently none of that would have been necessary. So what does that mean? I mean, that means that I suppose that you can be so completely bound up with the Creator and with the Almighty that look, there's no greater, pool of sensitivity and kindness and caring than God himself. So somehow or another, the more closely bound up we are with him, the more capable we are of feeling that compassion and that empathy for other people, almost irrespective of our own personal experience, which I think is very powerful. So granted, we went through Egypt, we actually learned the lessons the hard way, we relate it at least once a year at the Seder night so that we actually try to relive through those experiences, and we try to gain from them and make it part of our own, almost our own personal experience. But on another wavelength, what that means is that even if we don't live through an experience that somebody else might be going through, we can connect to those people, right? We can be empathetic towards other people.
But maybe it's a matter of faith.
Meaning purely by recognizing that divine spark, or recognizing that God gives and God is the ultimate source of goodness, that's something that we can tap into to be able to then turn around and care for people and be sensitive towards other people, almost irrespective of whether our own experiences do or don't match up with theirs.
I think that's a beautiful idea. The parsha ends with the commandment for circumcision, Brit Milah. And it's pretty fundamental, but it's also, I think, something which is in certain places controversial. There have been movements in Europe. I think in San Francisco there was activists opposing circumcision. The thing that I have heard is that this is responsible for Jewish neuroses, that circumcision takes everyone's neurotic because of the fact that they're circumcised. But like, what's your response when you if someone says this is like barbaric? Well, this is barbaric.
Look, like anything, I think the answer to all of these questions, this is really the answer to all of these questions, is that there is so much that we just don't understand about what it means to be a human being and occupy this universe. And at every turn, we look to the Torah, which is our manual for life, which is our series of instructions, and we have unyielding faith that whatever it is that God asks of us is appropriate. I think ultimately everything does fall into that bucket, even if we live in a generation and a time. And I think it's very dangerous to, I guess, capitulate to whatever the prevailing custom and prevailing whim may be at the time, and saying that, well, this generation, it's barbaric. A generation ago, it wasn't. And who knows what's going to happen later on. We believe that Torah applies to each and every generation. So we try not to just cast about by whatever the tide may be in any given generation. But I guess responding more directly, I think it's a remarkable thing that the Torah doesn't, the Torah doesn't shy away from anything. I think it's inescapable that the circumcision is on the male organ. And I think it's inescapable that it is bound up with our sense of relationships, with our sense of intimacy, with our sense of sexuality, and that those are things that can be reined in, that can be purified, but also that we don't need to hide from and don't need to run away from, that these are things that can be purified. And every one of those acts can be purified and can be done in a manner that's consistent with what the Torah would expect of us. I think it's an extraordinary statement about being able to take everything that makes us human and elevate it, even the most base of desires that we have. And I think that becomes a paradigm for everything else that we do as Jews.
I've seen people say that, circumcision's fine, but it's not fair to do it when the kid can't choose it, which I still feel is like a catch-22, because if you wait until they're old enough to choose it, it's going to hurt way more So that's, you know.
That's also, look, that's also fundamentally, I think, the most frightening thing that I've ever heard in my entire life.
That's the most frightening thing you've ever heard in your entire life?
Because effectively what that means is that parents have no right, authority, or responsibility to train their children. Meaning to say, would it be appropriate for me to teach my child manners in accordance with what I believe would be appropriate and proper etiquette?
Yeah, but there's...
Or should I wait until they're old enough for them to make those decisions on their own? Because by the time they actually get there, they won't be able to just rewrite the program. So should I just keep them in suspended animation until they're old enough to make all those decisions for themselves? Meaning, don't we as parents have a responsibility to, or teachers to children, to students, whatever it is, to train our children and to teach our children and to, yes, effectively, while they're still young, live their lives for them in a manner consistent with what our principles and values are?
I mean, I agree with you, and I agree with the first answer that we do it because the Torah says so. You know, and I think it's telling that the Torah doesn't say this, but like if the Torah said like huck off a leg, I don't know. You know, I think the fact that it's the foreskin is like, maybe I don't think anyone's missing it too much. Maybe I'm wrong. But I do think that's the difference though. You're cutting something off versus teaching manners. You know, you can decide for yourself later on, I didn't like my education, I'm gonna change, but you can't, you know, grow this thing back. That said, I'm not arguing against it. I know,
I was at both of your sons' brises. I'm well aware. But look, I think even just, you know, coming back to that point, the Torah doesn't say to remove somebody's leg, and the flap of skin that the Torah does tell us to remove clearly is extraneous and unnecessary. So
with that, I mean, I'll tell you, I feel like, you know, and this is a super like unfashionable thing to say if you like your religion to be, you know, all rational and everything, but like I think it's like blood brothers, you know, like you cut your hand and you mingle the blood. Like there's something deep about bleeding. And there's something really intense about the fact that, like, you know, like you're, you know, like
it's primal,
like Rafiki holding the Simba up in the air. You know, it's like this is the baby, and we're gonna, like, I don't know. It's like it's super intense. It's like it's very visceral, and to me, it's like that. Bris is the time when I feel like this thing is for real. I'm in a blood cult. It's not just like, oh, this makes sense to me. I accept it. I don't accept it. It's like I was, you know, cut. Like, you know, I don't know. It's an intense thing. And
my one final regret is that at my son's bris, I did not pick him high up over my head like Rafiki holding Simba. But win some, lose some.
Maybe you'll get another shot at that.
We'll see.
I think that's about all the time we have. We definitely skipped over some things, but you'll hopefully get it in Shul on Shabbos or in your own reading. Thank you, and have a good Shabbos. Always more to learn. The portion is recorded in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, produced by Aaron Roller with engineering help by Shira Rosenbaum. Our theme music is by Simply Tzfat. See you all next week. Bye-bye.